Orny, you ready to take some questions today?
Absolutely. Let's go.
We got some good ones. That's coming up. Welcome to Hockey Central, Jeff Merrick. Alongside Justin Bourne, Gary Lawless, Vegas Golden Knights insider, joins us bottom of the hour. I'm going to try, Justin, to squeeze in at least a couple of old school Peterborough Pete's questions in for Lawless. That's where he got his start. But we're going to spend a lot of time taking questions. Haven't done this in a while. Hashtag HC Game Sheet is the way to get us on social. But really quick, before we get there, a couple of things. One, do you follow Connor McDavid on Twitter?
You know, I don't think I do, because he's one of those guys that if he says something interesting, it's going to find its way to my feed.
Okay, so there's, like, he put up a video this morning of him essentially just, like, taking passes, skating around cones, just really sort of basic stuff, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, here's someone that, I don't know, like, whenever you see him play, like, there are, we've always talked about, you pay, people that you would actually pay money to see play, and there's probably only about, what do you figure, 10, maybe 12 people, maybe even less for some, that you would actually pay money just to watch play. McDavid's on everybody's list. On everybody's list. And much like the greats before him, and I think this specifically with Sidney Crosby. Remember when Crosby started and it was like, wow, the kid's phenomenal. He's wonderful, offensively gifted, doesn't cheat the game, etc., but was horrible at faceoffs. Like, just terrible at faceoffs. Like, that was the one area where he was just getting gobbled up. So much like much like Crosby, what I'm told is that McDavid has spent a big part of the summer working on faceoffs. Like, the player that you could say is the best in the league is about to get better. Where are you at on Connor McDavid in the conversations of right now, the greats in the game today? Throw your Crosbys, throw your McKinnons. Some, like me as well, would throw in your Jack Eichels. Where's McDavid for you?
He's the guy. He's the guy. He's still, he's at the top of my list. I feel like, you know, some people may quibble that he could be more well-rounded or whatever, but, like, okay, he is the most dynamic, the most talented, the highest ceiling, the most, like, all right, one guy on the ice, you want to make something happen, he's that dude for me. I have a couple questions about the whole working on a face-off thing, which, like, what do you do exactly? Like, you need someone out there who can take face-offs well, and if you take it against the same guy on repeat, like, I feel like you're dealing with that guy and their tendencies. It's a hard thing to improve at.
Yeah.
And one other note on that is just, I admire people who work on things that they know they're not good at. I think if you watch a lot of hockey players, and this sounds obvious, but you'll see a lot of guys with great shots working on one-timers after practice. You'll see a lot of great skaters working on skating. You don't often see people genuinely find weakness and go to work on it, because it's not fun. It's frustrating.
See, I've always felt that in a lot of ways, face-offs are about strength. And sure, a lot of it is strategy. A lot of it is tactics. But I've always felt that a lot of it, and listen, Bourne, you've worked with these guys being video coaches before and played hockey at the pro level. What is it that makes someone better at face-offs? Is it studying the other person's tendencies? Like, everyone goes in with a game plan, right? Like, I'm going in there against Getzlaff. I'm going against Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. I'm going against Kopitar or whatever. What goes into it?
Part of it, honestly, is interest level. And, like, that, it's reflective of a certain type of player. The players who take care of details all over the ice tend to be good at face-offs, because it's a matter of, you know, millimeters sometimes of getting yourself in that right position and focusing and wanting it and believing it's important. I think about guys, you know, we had Colin Greening when I was at the Marlies, and he was a winger for most of his career, but we wanted to make him a center just because with the personnel we had at the time. And man, in typical fashion with this game, big, strong guy, he put in the work and he watched video of how to get better at it. And he had people drop pucks and took draws against all the other centermen on the team. And he got good at taking faceoffs. And it's just indicative of the type of player he was. And so I don't know if there's one attribute that makes you good at faceoffs, but I do think it's reflective of the type of player who's detail-oriented.
Many who don't place value on faceoffs will say it's only the beginning of a series, of a chain of events in the long chain of possession. What are your thoughts on faceoffs? You subscribe to that? That's only, it's only one part of a chain.
Yeah. Well, I understand that, and there are there is much dispute of like, okay, if you're a 45% faceoff guy or 55, you know, how much does that affect, you know, where the shots go when you're on the ice? It's a source of much contention because old school hockey people love faceoffs, to talk faceoffs, heavily believe in them.
You know why? It's quantifiable. Yeah. And it satisfies both
someone
who has an analytic bent to them and an eyeball, because you can see it. The evidence is right there. So you think it's important.
I mean, I still think it's more important than some of the early work that the analytics community did that basically said not that important. I think it's more important than that. But the biggest thing is just offensive zone face-off draws, or even in either zone, offensive, defensive. Because in the neutral zone, it's not a huge, huge thing. Often a one neutral zone face-off results in a dump-in, which results in the other team breaking the puck out. Like, it doesn't result in much of danger. But in the offensive zone, you know, you win or lose one more extra draw. It can be a goal, which can be a game, which can be standings, points, and playoffs. So I understand why there's more commitment from a lot of old school people on the importance of faceoffs.
Okay. Away from the minutia and back to Connor McDavid here. And this is our first question. I want to get your thoughts on Mikko Lehtinen, by the way, today, who was released from his contract with Jokerit. So the next step is head to Toronto. But in the meantime, Marcel Schoenhardt submits this one, speaking of Connor McDavid. Assuming, Borny, that this is a 60-game season, Connor McDavid scores 100 points, yes or no? 60 games, 100 points for McDavid, two-foot putt, easy for sure?
Yeah, you know, we're being denied the seasons. Like, when you look at Hockey DB for Gretzky and you go through, it's like, oh man, like right around his fourth, fifth season in the league, you know, there were some absolute gaudy numbers. I don't have them in front of me, but like any great, great, great Hall of Famer of the game hits these years, and these are McDavid's, and we're being denied pure normal seasons. I would imagine that this season, you know, this, if he's ever going to hit 2 points a game, it's now. And I don't think I would not rule out McDavid, you know, getting to a 2 point a game number at least once in his career.
All right, we'll get to a few more here. We got a bunch to get to, and again, Gary Lawless coming up towards the bottom of the hour. This is an interesting one. This is going to ask you to put your thinking toque on here on Hockey Central. Kevin Coyle, who is the best player / GM ever? Yzerman, Sakic, Hextall. Kevin submits, totally unbiased, would say Yzerman. That from Kevin. The best player / GM. I'm almost inclined to put Glenn Sather at maybe the top of that list.
See, I feel like you would have a deeper pool to draw from here than me because of your knowledge. Some of these guys, I'm like, wait, Jim Rutherford was a goalie? You know, like,
he was, wings.
You know, like, I literally oblivious to some of the playing.
Doug Wilson was a defenseman? What? Doug Wilson played D? What? I had no idea.
Well, look, if you ask a kid in their 20s, you know, about Doug Wilson, they'll tell you he's a GM. You know, it's a different thing. So I am more present-day oriented. Yzerman's a great pick, but Joe Sakic is doing in Colorado, man. And he hasn't been there that long, and they look poised to be a favorite in the NHL for a cup. Where are you on this conversation?
My default to this, because you look at the history of some of the greats, and I always maintained, I know that everyone says Sam Pollock was the guy, and Sam Pollock was the great at taking over from Frank Selke, who was another really good general manager in the NHL. For me, the greatest general manager that I saw in the history of the NHL was the guy that your father played for, Bill Torrey.
And did he play? I have no idea. Did he play?
Well, okay. So when you say did he play, are you talking about just the NHL? Like, do you have to play in the NHL, or can you play a couple years at St. Lawrence?
I don't know. You know, I am and my playing history, I'm going to say that counts as playing. That counts. What do you mean? That's enough.
I think the implication is National Hockey League or at least WHA for some of these guys. I think of the guys right now. I mean, I know that he has his detractors, but you can put Ken Holland in that conversation, who did play a handful of games in the NHL. Yzerman is the obvious one. Who built, with all due respect to Julien Brisebois, that Tampa Bay Lightning team. And he was almost, you know, he was almost reluctant to go to Tampa in the first place. So we kind of forget that it took some major luring to get him from Detroit to Tampa. And then from there, it was a masterclass in how to build a contender. Red Wings fans hoping he can duplicate that now in Detroit. Rutherford is an obvious one that you mentioned because of the Stanley Cup success. To me, maybe the most impressive is 2006 with Carolina, but certainly with the Pittsburgh Penguins. I think Sakic is a good one. But, you know, by and large, you know, the history of the league wasn't that you're a player and then you become a general manager somewhere down the road. It was you were a manager, and that's what you did, whether you're Selke. I mean, these guys all played at some level, but not the NHL level. Whether you're Selke, whether you're, you know, Sam Pollock, whether you're any of these guys, that's why I'll put Sather in that mix for the top players/GMs ever.
This is a you know, while we're talking about them, the analytics community tends to be a more, not just a number community, but a more forward thinking community that, you know, maybe the way we've always done it is not always the right way. And one of the contentions is just that, like, what are the odds that the people who are the best at managing and running a hockey organization also happen to have been some of the best players in NHL history? Like, they're logically, there's no reason to think Joe Sakic should be any better at that than, you know, whoever of his teammates from those Colorado Avalanche teams, or someone who went to MIT, or someone who, you know, just followed the game closely and is a very smart individual. So I would say that their push is just that we need to open our minds, and baseball has done this to some extent, looking beyond people who are former players to find the right candidates.
I think we're getting there. Don't you feel? Yeah. I mean, hockey is generally hockey kind of goes kicking and screaming, doesn't it? Into a lot of these conversations, like especially the analytics argument, which people are still being dragged kicking and screaming into, even though the argument is over.
Yeah.
It's done. Like,
the
conversation has been exactly. It's over. It's finished. But I'm with you. I think we're getting there. Like, listen, we've seen, you know, Jay Feaster was a Stanley Cup general manager. Last time I checked, lawyer. You know, so it does happen. Like, you don't have to have the quote unquote NHL credentials, I don't think, to be a successful NHL general manager. I don't.
And I do think that, as you mentioned, is changing. Seattle's done a good job looking outside of the box for other candidates. And it will change as we go forward. At the end of the day, the business is getting more and more cutthroat. There's less room to just have your buddies on staff. It's a multi-billion dollar business at this point. You need the right people, not the people you liked from 20 years ago.
All right. This one's an interesting one. This from at Dan Straight Edge. He gets a lot of credit, as he should, but why don't we talk about Sidney Crosby in legendary terms? He's top 10 all time, yet I still feel he's underappreciated.
What is that guy talking about?
I don't know. Hang on a second. Hang on. In the list and the pantheon of the greats, okay? When we're talking Gretzky and we're talking Rocket and we're talking Orr and we're talking, I would put Lidstrom right there as well. As we're talking about these players, where are you putting Crosby?
Go on Twitter and say Sidney Crosby's underrated and see the response you get. It's an insane thing to say. It's insanity. I mean, he is a legend. He is one of the all-time greats. He's going to go down as one of the top 10 greatest players to have ever played this game in public perception if you don't have him there already. By the way, that's easy to say until you start putting a list together. But he is. I think he's easily perceived as that. I don't see him as any other way. I mean, the guy's in his mid-30s now, and I still think you consider him one of the best forwards. If you could pick your team today for this upcoming season, Sidney Crosby goes, you know, in the top five centers in almost every GM's draft. Well, top three.
How about top players of all time? So we're talking like Howe, Gretzky, this pantheon.
Yeah. I mean,
Mario.
It's really tough to land.
I know you love Mario.
You want Mario or Sid?
Mario or Sid. Pick one, Forney. Oh, this is where I love being host and would hate being an analyst.
No. How do you win here? How do you win? So we got a playoff series coming up tomorrow. Is that what you're telling me? And I get either player in their prime? Mario. Yeah. Give me Mario.
One-on-one skill, probably the best in the game ever. True or false? Mario Lemieux.
Yeah, man, it's there. The guy was 6 foot six, insane dangles. His peak is higher than Gretzky's peak. Ah, did I just say that? No, I'm gonna get killed for that.
Different styles of players, right? Like one-on-one, you were terrified of Gretzky just because of how he could use the ice and everyone around him. Mario, you were just scared of one-on-one because of what he could do to you. Like, how many guys did he completely embarrass? Jock strap spinning. That was Mario.
You know what I got killed for? I got eviscerated on Twitter for this take. Peak Evgeny Malkin is better than peak Ovechkin or peak Crosby. So at his best. Best night.
There were, I think, if you're going to talk about underrated players, underrated great players, I'll throw Malkin into that conversation all day long. And that just might be skating in the shadow of Crosby in Pittsburgh. There were many at that draft when Ovechkin went first and Malkin went second. I remember talking to one team specifically, and they were not near the top five, so they weren't getting either. And I said, well, easy for you to say. You don't have to make that decision. Who were trying to convince me, and they showed me their draft list, and they had Malkin number one over Ovechkin. And their point was, Ovechkin's a better player right now, but overall and over the course of the career, Malkin will be better. I don't know about that one.
Didn't work out.
As it's played out, and Ovechkin has become the greatest goal scorer the game has ever seen, but there were a lot of teams that felt that over the course of the careers, that Malkin was going to be the better player.
Well, I think it's probably because of the point that I'm making, which is just when you see him on, he controls a hockey game. If you put your finger in, like, let's say you poured a bunch of molasses on a tray and put your finger in the middle of the tray and dragged it around, everything follows the finger. He moves the action. It goes with him. He plows the field, Jeff. He is an absolute horse when he is on, in a way that I don't know that Sid or Ovi control the action in the same way that it is Evgeny Malkin's puck in game when he's at his best.
So here's another interesting one. Do you read many hockey books, or have you read many hockey books?
I have read many hockey books, but the honest answer is at this point in my life, I don't feel like I'm learning a ton. So I wait for people to say, you got to read this one.
Okay. So this comes from @SmokesIndoors. What are some must reads in terms of hockey books? Doesn't have to be new ones on the market, could be of the all-time category. Interested in fave reads. This is probably for an entire program, to be honest with you. But just off the top of your head, a couple that have, and everyone always says, oh, The Game by Ken Dryden. which come to mind for you?
Honestly, Jeff, that's the one that, like, moved the needle for me too. There's a reason it has the reputation it does. I thought it was that good. You know, I started out in my reading career starting out with Scrubs on Skates. Do you remember Scrubs on Skates?
Yeah, I do remember Scrubs on Skates.
There was a series of books there. I forget what the other one was called. The Boy from Leafs Camp, maybe something like that. But when I was a kid, I started reading hockey books like that, and ventured out into more autobiographies, and, you know, reading the Gretzky one was all, was impactful in my life. I only started because my dad's name was in it. but beyond that, you know, I haven't dabbled too much into hockey autobiographies.
There's, if I really sat down and made a better list, I should do that. Let's do that for next week. Sit down and make a list. We got Berkey on next week, and Stewie's coming back too. So we'll get out of the whole.
Have you read Berkey's Law by Brian? What a spectacular tome.
I have not read it yet because I don't have a copy yet. Wink, wink.
Yeah. You kidding me? Berkey's waiting for you to lay out that $30 at Indigo. That's, you're looking for a discount.
I have what we like to refer to as an onion wallet, Borny. Every time I open it, I start crying. So I'll just wait for the free 99 copy. So a few come to mind right away. I think if you want to look at the business of the game, one of the most eye-opening ones is from... And it sort of documents a lot of what happened in 04-05 during the lockout, and that's Money Players by Bruce Dobigan, which I think is outstanding. If you go back to, if you look at autobiographical books, one of the most interesting ones is from one of the more interesting players I think the game has ever seen. And whenever anyone asks me, if you could pick one person in the history of hockey to have Twitter who wouldn't have had it in his era, who would that be? I'll tell you, Gump Worsley. And they call me Gump, which is well out of print. And even if you can find it, I mean, this thing is like $70 to $100 if you can find it anywhere, whether Amazon, Abe Books, wherever. It's a fascinating read. I mean, it's just the way that he talks about himself, the way that he talks about coaches, the way that he talks about other players, like no holds barred, Gump Worsley. And he's got, he puts in it, like it's a really interesting sort of peek inside the head of Gump Worsley. He's got a recipe in there for pineapple squares. Just out of nowhere, he puts in that.
They must be really good.
It's an awesome book, Barney. And there's one section devoted to his favorite places to drink in every single market.
Like, you know, I can't say I haven't thought about publishing the AHL version of that. Right? If you want to know where to drink in the AHL's North Division, yeah,
these are the places to go. And then as far as, you know, one of my favorite books, oh, by the way, Deceptions and Double Cross, The Origins of the NHL is a fascinating read, too. But Without a Trace is one of my favorites, the Bill Barilko story by Kevin Shea, which is, and I've been fascinated with Barilko.
That's my next one, Jeff. I've heard you mention it. I haven't read it.
It's
That's
so
my,
good.
My next to read.
Without a Trace, and Kevin Shea is such a wonderful, wonderful writer and does a great job with this one. So those would be the ones just top of my head, but is probably... for a bigger conversation when we get the whole band together here. Rob K, should the NHL make the ice surface bigger next season? Well, they can't. But should they? Should they have a look at eventually making rinks bigger?
You know, I don't know how to answer this exactly because I don't think it necessarily makes for a better hockey game or a better... style of hockey. I love that you have to make things happen quickly in hockey. A turnover means a chance, and you know you're kind of all you're never too far from the net to score a goal. So I like that. I don't think from a epidemiologist perspective, a much bigger rink is going to make much of a difference if that's what the implication is there. But going back to the big picture thing, you know, tough to ask NHL buildings to take away more front row seats, put less seats in their building. I don't know.
But you're not really taking away front row seats, though, because, you know, the second level seats now become your first
right.
section seats. So you're taking seats from the back.
Yeah, that's fair. But I guess I just don't see it, Jeff. I like the NHL as it currently is. I played on Olympic ice in college, and I loved it. It's a lot of fun, but I don't think it provides a better product or more meaningful hockey in any way.
Okay, so not 200 by 100, but what about a Finnish style then? 200 by 92?
Yeah.
So you have a little bit more room wide?
I take that. I take a compromise. That sounds great to me. Yeah, we can use a little more space. I don't know if we need 15 feet more, but yeah, I do that. As GM of the NHL,
I remember. I remember talking once, this is years ago, to Igor Larionov. This is when he was still playing. Or I might have just retired. I can't recall now. And I asked him what rink size he enjoyed playing on more, the international ice surface of 200 by 100 or the NHL 200 by 85. And I was expecting the artist, right, to talk about needing the biggest canvas and more room to maneuver and creativity and all that. And he said the NHL size is better for creativity. And I said, I never would have thought you would say that. And he said, look, you step over the blue line in the international size and you still essentially need a GPS to find the net. Meanwhile, if I step over the blue line in the NHL, right away, I'm almost right away in a scoring position. So that sort of reinforces your point. And here is probably, Borny, one of the most creative players to ever play the game, Igor Larionov.
Yeah,
what's
interesting is you tend to think that more room is advantageous for the better players. Oh, imagine Datsyuk with all the room to maneuver out there. But it's actually the opposite. It's the guys who are less talented now have more room to think and come up with something, where it's the guys who could think quickly in these tight spaces that had the advantage. You know, it's the old idea that golf courses saw Tiger Woods hitting the golf ball a million miles and they got longer to Tiger-proof it. Well, that just screwed everyone else who already wasn't hitting it as long as Tiger. It played into his hands. It didn't hurt him. And that's, right. You know, guys like Datsyuk and the Sedin brothers, they're great small space players because they think quicker than everyone else and they are more creative than everyone else. Bigger ice actually is an advantage for those who are a little bit slower thinking.
I do wonder, though, if the NHL has sort of missed a moment here with this, you know, whether it's, you know, Columbus or Pittsburgh or Edmonton, cities with new arenas. I always do wonder if the NHL should have mandated that as they built the rinks, they had the ability to easily slash quickly, i.e. maybe during the off season, to make them larger.
Insane that they haven't. You're 100% right. Like, they should at least have afforded themselves that flexibility.
Yeah, like somewhere down the road, folks, we're gonna get there. So when you build, when you make your buildings, make sure it can accommodate. This is from our friend Dale Hunter's Helmet. Will the Leafs ever retire Rick Vibes number 22? HC Game Sheet hashtag.
This is a question. I just
got his book yesterday. Speaking of books, I just got his book yesterday. I'm looking forward to reading that one.
Like it's a you know, exclusive club to get into of four people. I mean,
he's the first 50 for the Maple Leafs, not the first 50 in Toronto. That was Shooter Simpson in, with the Toronto Toros. So you might say, ah, that doesn't really count, Merrick. But nonetheless, there it is. 350 goal seasons in a row. I mean, mind you, it was a bad Maple Leafs team, but he was a bright spot. For me, it's an easy one, and it's yes, the 350 goal seasons for Rick Vive, for sure. If I'm the Maple Leafs, I'm retiring 22 yesterday.
What are the Leafs going to do in like 50 years? By the way, I agree with you. I think they should retire his number, but like once all these numbers are retired, I mean, they're going to have to go to into triple digits here at some point, Jeff.
Boston's the same way.
Number 106 for your Maple Leafs.
Almost out of numbers.
Lamoriello would have a fit. He would have an absolute fit if you tried to wear 999 on the ice or something.
Here come the NASCAR numbers, right? Look out. Yeah. Here come your training camp numbers. Everyone's got a training camp number now. I retire Vibes all day. I've always had a soft spot in my heart. The combination, one of the great underrated combinations in the history of Toronto hockey was Builder Lego to Rick Vive. And I still think Builder Lego, as far as skill goes, was fantastic. Now, did he bring it every night? Did he want to bring it every night? No. But you look at players that when they're on, and I'm not going to compare him to Malkin, which you mentioned, like when he's on, he's the best player in the game. But when Builder Lego was on, he was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And even if you look at that first 50, Rick Vive scores on Mike Liut, St. Louis Blues.
I was going to say, yeah.
That whole play is Builder Lego. And it's a beautiful pass to RV for the one-timer. For me, Vive all day. That's an easy one. From Jonathan Davis, hey, our buddy out in Los Angeles. If the Jets keep Line A, who gets moved?
That's a great question. I'll be honest. I've been sitting here waiting for Line A to happen. I'm still 58.6% sure it's going to be Line A. Otherwise, I don't know. They're in an interesting position there in Winnipeg.
What's that? Sorry?
They're in an interesting position. I mean, what do you do with this guy? Line A in particular, he doesn't seem to be overly happy. He's a coveted asset, but if people know you want to trade him, there's...
I just hate giving up on players that young. Yeah. You know, we referenced Sam Pollock earlier. What did Sam Pollock always say? Never give up on a young player until you are 100%. Like, the NHL is littered with general managers that have given up on young players too early instead of working through. I think the NHL has historically had a hard time in handling young players and has done a really poor job of it generally. But, man, how do you let that go with that potential?
Tough to imagine a deal where you look back at it and go, Winnipeg sure came out on top there.
No kidding. All right, we're going to hit a break. Speaking of Winnipeg, someone that used to live in and work in that market, now in Vegas, as an insider for the Vegas Golden Knights, is our good friend Gary Lawless. By the way, thanks to everyone who tweeted in. We'll do that again. Maybe do it next week. I don't want to get to that book show as well. We should probably do that next week as well. Gary Lawless, Vegas Golden Knights insider, joins us next as Hockey Central continues. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Welcome back to the program here Monday to Friday starting at noon. Jeff Merrick alongside Justin Bourne. This is Hockey Central. Joined on the line now by way of Winnipeg, by way of Peterborough, now in Vegas. Insider for the Vegas Golden Knights, our good friend Gary Lawless. How are you today, Gary?
You skipped Thunder Bay. Can't forget my good years in Thunder Bay, but I'm fantastic. How are you?
How long were you in Thunder Bay?
It's long enough to watch Mel... the Mangler Engelstad fight, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 times. I covered that. My first beat was the USHL, the Thunder Bay Flyers. It was like the very end of that of that team. They got they moved on shortly after that. But then Friday night I'd cover the Flyers. Saturday night I would cover the Colonial Hockey League, the Thunder Bay Centers.
Wow.
Thunder Bay Centers. Bruce Ramsey, Mel Engelstad, Vern Ray. Who am I missing? Tom Warden. He's now the athletic director at Lakehead University. Has gray hair and wears glasses and looks like he's a respectable educator. He was a complete thug on the ice. It was they had. If you cover the Ontario Hockey League, you remember Jason Firth. So Firth, he would have he'd have a dart hanging out of his mouth while he was while he was heating up his stick, and then he'd go out and get two and three, and then he would get, Randy Carlisle would try and bring him to the Manitoba Moose every year, and Jason just, he'd go up there and, have to deal with Carlisle's ranting and raving and playing on the fourth line. He'd be like, nah, send me back to Thunder Bay. You play 40 minutes a night and just had a blast. The chant there in Thunder Bay was start the bus. And in the third, because they'd play Friday and Saturday back to back. So Utica would come up. Utica had Jacques Mayotte, who I never saw.
Jacques Mayotte. Oh, he played for my dad. What a guy.
I never saw Jacques lose to Engelstad. He'd have to fight Engelstad on Friday night, and they'd have to fight Ramsey on Saturday night, and he would beat them both. For my money, in minor league hockey, the best fighter I ever saw. Mel fought a million times.
Yeah.
Couldn't beat John, and neither could Bruce Ramsey. Bruce Ramsey, twice a year, would get beat up by the Hells Angels or the Saints Choice or whoever it was in Thunder Bay. And then he got called up. He played for Milwaukee and Grand Rapids in the IHL, and I think Rammer's a coach now somewhere in somewhere out there. But my Thunder Bay days they were fantastic.
Okay, pause on this. We're going to call you back. Your line's kind of crackling a little bit, Garrett, and we're going to call you back in 2 seconds. But I'm glad you mentioned. I'll share a quick story here as we try to get Gary back on the program here and get a better line. Mel Engelstad, who I believe was the first to wear the number 69 in the NHL, the Washington Capitals. I remember talking to him, Justin. I think it would have been 2007, maybe 2008. It's maybe 2009. I was doing Hockey Day in Canada with CBC and Hockey Night in Canada. And it was in Winkler. So it was a big focus on Winkler. We have Gary back. I'm just telling a quick story about Engelstad. The last time that I spoke to him, Gary, would have been maybe 2008. I think he was working as a fireman in Manitoba. And we were talking about his career. And I said, what was one of your, we're talking about his highlights, and Gary, you'll love this. And he said, it was an exhibition game. We were playing, I think it would have been Chicago. I think Probert was on Chicago by then. And he said, I asked Probert to go, do me the honors. And Proby's always like, yeah, kid, people did it for the vets did it for me when I was a rookie, and I'll do it for you. And Engelstad says, we dropped the gloves and here I am with my hero. And he's got me against the boards, and he hits me like 4 or 5 times in the face really fast. And the only thing that I can think about was, oh, man, this is so cool. Bob Probert is punching me in the face. This is a dream come true. Is that the Mel Engelstad that you remember, Gary?
Mel was this was in the days of Spectravision, and Mel had the special screwdriver to fix things in the hotel room. He was a really great, fun guy, and one of the highlights of my career actually, I was in Portland, Maine, and covering the American Hockey League, and it was sitting down at a bar, and this was one of the very first cell phones I had. The phone rings, and it's Randy Carlisle. And Randy never phoned me. I always had to phone him. And so I'm like, this is going to be interesting. And so he handed me the phone. I said, what's up? He said, I got someone I want to talk. I want you to talk to. And he handed the phone to Mel. Mel had just played his first game in the National Hockey League. George McPhee paid Mel the tribute of, after protecting all his guys for so many years, and, you know, fighting for, you know, keeping the flies off the honey. He gave Mel a game. Mel wore an interesting number. And Randy wanted Mel to get his due in Manitoba, where he spent a ton of time. So he just phoned me and handed the phone to Mel. And I'm like, Mel, what's going on? He goes, I just played a game in the NHL. And I didn't know. I'd covered a game in Portland that afternoon. I think it might have been the day that Mike Weir won the Masters. They all kinds of jumbles together. Because I can remember watching the end of the Masters in the lobby in Portland, and they're all raving about, oh, he's a lefty. And I'm like, he's a Canadian. And they're like, no, he's not. I'm like, yeah, he's a Canadian. And it was, I got a lot of time for Mel. He works, he's not in Manitoba anymore. He's out in BC still brings a group of guys to Vegas every year for a hockey tournament, but not this year. And, I talked to him this summer for something. I forget what it was. Maybe I was with Darren Banks, and Banksy wanted to know what Mel was up to. All those guys that fought, they all want to know how they're all doing. So anyways, I'm going on too much about Mel. What's up?
Borny, over to you. That's some great stuff on Mel Engelstad. I was surprised on a Friday afternoon. Go ahead, Borny.
Well, while we're just sticking with the obscure theme, a quick story on Jacques Mayotte, who played in the Western Professional Hockey League for the Central Texas Stampede. The whole Whipple, who my dad was coaching. I was visiting as a kid from out of town. My first experience watching hockey at that level, like 12 years old. Mayotte gets in a fight behind the net, and the Zamboni doors behind the net blow open. So after the fight, Mayotte is hot and chasing around the ref for whatever reason. The ref runs off the ice onto the cement through the Zamboni doors, and Mayotte runs after him, literally chasing the man on his skates on cement. And another player chases Mayotte, and they're standing there on cement fighting on hockey skates. I've never been more impacted by a hockey fight in my life. Mayotte had nearly 300 penalty minutes in like 30 some games that year. What a player! What a player Jacques Mayotte was. Which brings me to a question.
You wore a little Jofa bucket, right?
Yeah, barely a helmet at all, really. So, yeah, Gary, yeah. Do you miss that version of hockey? When you watch hockey today, do you think back to, you know, what you grew up watching? Do you miss the way hockey used to be played?
You know, I'm of two minds, right? Like, there was a point in my time, I think it was John Craighead. I think it was Craighead and Ramsey. And Ramsey's head hit the ice. This was in the American League or the International League, and his head hit the back of his head hit the ice, and there was that sound, you know, and it like turned my stomach. So, I saw some gratuitous stuff. So that I don't miss that, but. You know, like those guys were characters. And then also you read about what some of them went through later on, like, you know, the alcoholism and the anxiety of, and the pills and all of that. So like do I miss the lollipop of watching a fight? Yeah, for sure.
Right.
But I also know what it does to your teeth. Right. And that's, so you know what I mean? I guess Blake Wheeler and Mark Stone got in a fight last year or 2 years ago, and it was, you know, it was two guys that could really play, that were big men, and they got tired of one another, so they had a fist fight, and you know, it was over, no one got hurt, and I was like, okay, I can stomach that, you know what I mean? That I like. I also always go back to. You know what I mean? If I had to put my son, you know, in the family car and send him off down the road to Peterborough or Oshawa or wherever to play junior, and you know, some guy got their hands on him that decided he was going to be a fighter and was going to make him do that to forward his own career. Like, there's all kinds of things that go along with it. And yeah, like I love the part of it of, you know, the intimidation of a guy saying, you know, my friend Kerry Huffman played for the Guelph Platers, and Bill LaForge coached the Hamilton Steelhawks. They were building Cops Coliseum that year. So the Steelhawks played up in the Mountain Arena, and they had Corson, they had Brad Dalgarno, they had
I think we're losing Gary. Gary, you still there? All right, let's give him a call back one more time since we're winding up on a good Bill LaForge story about playing up on the rink in the mountain there. I think maybe Alex Stoyanov might have been on that Steelhawks team that he was playing for, but that was a real, real tough squad. You know, the interesting point about Gary, we have you back. You were talking about the Bill LaForge team with Dalgarno and Corse. Was Alex Stoyanov on that team too?
I don't remember that. I was living in Peterborough, but Huffman always tells the story that, you know, Roberts fought Corson, and, you know, and as he was skating to the penalty box, looked at the guys on the Guelph bench and winked at them like, no one's pushing us around anymore, guys. And that was that. And they won the Memorial Cup. So, like, that part of the game, yeah, absolutely love it. But it's, again, there's a toll that comes along with it.
You know what? It's interesting because you're talking about, you know, Wheeler and Stone having a fight, just two, you know, high-end, high-level players that are just frustrated and fed up with each other and just throw down. The most famous one in this, you know, this recent era was, of course, Ginla and LeCavalier in the playoffs. But, you know, Dick Irvin would always make this point. And I remember talking to him on Hockey Night Radio years and years ago. And we were talking about the violence from, you know, years gone past. And he said, look, you always have to keep in mind one thing when you're talking about, you know, the 40s and the 50s and even into the 60s. John Ferguson changed all this. But he said, you know, that was the era where the best players in the league were also the toughest. You know, whether it was Rocket, whether it was Gordy, whether it was, you know, any of these guys, Hull. Like, these guys, as much as they were Ted Lindsay, as much as they were great hockey players, they were also tough. We lost Gary. I'm having a hard time with Gary's phone today here,
Warren.
But that is an interesting point that Irvin would always make. There was an era, and maybe we're getting back there in some respects now, sort of, where the best players were also the toughest players in the league.
Yeah, well, you kind of had to be, right? I was actually tweeting yesterday about some 90s hockey, John Casey and Brian Trotche, and just how different times were. And someone said, what if you put John Gibson in net in that era? How many times did he get scored on in the season? He has his current pads and his current ability. And a great response, someone said, was we'd never know because they'd kill him. You know, someone would run him, some coach would be like, oh, that guy's too good or whatever. That was the thinking of that era, was that if you were too good, they'd just kill you. They would just go after you. There's plenty of stories about Team Canada playing Russia and guys just saying, well, I'm just going to chop his ankle off because that guy's too good a skater.
Harlamov.
You know,
Harlamov. That happened to Harlamov.
So that's it, where a lot of these guys, it's like, yeah, they had to be the best players, you had to be tough, or people just took you out.
Are we getting Gary back? Do we know if Gary's come?
The phone's pooched.
Might be pooched. Okay, well, tell you what. Let's hit a break. We brought him on to talk about the Vegas Golden Knights. We have him. We got you back. We wanted to have you on to talk about the Vegas Golden Knights. We ended up talking about Mel Engelstad. Give us a sort of a snapshot of where Vegas is as a hockey team right now, heading to, fingers crossed, what we think will be a new season come January 1st.
Well, I think that they have to be one of the favorites. I think that great goaltending, they added the best available free agent and a top five defenseman in the NHL. And again, you know, it's one of the things that you always kind of look for. Shea Theodore will be better this year. Alex Tuck will be better this year. Cody Glass, I think, is going to step through. Zach Whitecloud will be better. I think they're going to be better than they were last year.
And, you know, this is, since we're all over the map today, I'm going to stick with it, Gary, and I just wanted to know about the difference for you personally covering the Winnipeg Jets in the Winnipeg Winters and what it's like being in Las Vegas and covering that hockey team.
I golfed yesterday. I think I grew up in Peterborough and played at the Kawartha Golf and Country Club and had a love for the game. And then I didn't play for like a long time. And then I had my daughter and I didn't play. My wife and I bought a cottage. So, you know, I just kind of got out of the game and then I've kind of been forced back into it. And, we played a great course yesterday, a bunch of us from the office, and it's been, it's kind of that the lifestyle here is pretty tremendous. And love the fact that I get to go back to Manitoba for the summer.
That's outstanding. That's a lot of fun. We got to do this again soon. And we swear next time we'll talk more about Vegas, but those are some wonderful detours with you today. Gary, thanks as always. Be well. Fingers crossed. We'll see what happens here between the NHL and Players Association. If they get this thing sorted out and get this game going again in the new year. Thanks so much as always for stopping by. That was a lot of fun, bud.
Yeah, sorry about the... I came to the office to do this so to get on a good phone line. I apologize that we had trouble. Have a
Don't
great afternoon, guys.
No worries. Not at all. A problem. Thanks, pal. There he is, Gary Lawless, Vegas Golden Knights insider, covering the Vegas Golden Knights. Always an interesting conversation with Gary Lawless. We had a break. More Hockey Central here in a couple of moments. Smith and Jones, by the way, top of the hour. More HC with yours truly and Justin Bourne in moments. Keep it here. All right, just about 90 seconds here. Justin Smith and Jones, top of the hour on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Around Leafland, where the news stories following today, 26-year-old Mikko Lehtinen, free agent signing last season, 17 points in 17 KHL games, has been released from his contract in Jokerits. He went through a bout of COVID-19 himself. He's been released from his contract. Next stop is the Toronto Maple Leafs. How do you temper expectations for someone who's had success overseas? And it's not as if he's 18, 19 years old. He's 26 years old. How do you temper expectations, or what are your expectations for someone coming into the Maple Leafs fold with this resume?
Well, what's really nice now is the Leafs have a history now of having players come from overseas and been given opportunity, and it's kind of up to the players in very Mike Babcockian fashion, who I believe we'll mention as well, was fired a year ago today.
True.
You know, you decide as the player. You decide. If you're good enough, they're going to play you. They want to win. So here you go. Here is your opportunity, and it'll be up to him if he plays or not.
All right, personal question. Are you golfing today?
No, I wish. It's a PA day. The kid's home. Ugh.
Oh, otherwise, you'd be golfing, going for a nice run. Oh, I'm out on a patio instead.
Not so much.
Welcome to the real world, Borny. Welcome to the real world.